You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm your host, as always, Ankit Panda, and I'm joined today by my colleagues at the Diplomat, Shannon Tiazi and Prashant Parameshwaran. Thanks a lot for joining me today, guys.
Good to be here.
Sure, always good to talk, Ankit.
Great. So we'll be devoting this week's podcast to a discussion of North Korea's recent behavior, focusing primarily on its satellite launch last Sunday. So over the past weekend, North Korea launched its fourth satellite. Its first two tests were failures, but its last two, the previous one being in 2012, have succeeded insofar as they were able to place an object in orbit. And I say object because we don't really know if the so-called Earth observation satellite that North Korea claims to have launched is even functional, or if it's simply a cover for testing missile technology, which is what most intelligence in South Korea and the United States believe. North Korea claimed that it launched this Earth observation satellite, but we don't really even know if Pyongyang scientists have been able to contact the satellite or retrieve any information or satellite imagery. In 2012, they claimed that the satellite that they launched was actually broadcasting hymns, the hymn of Kim Il-sung and the hymn of Kim Jong-il, into outer space. So maybe they'll come back with that excuse again. Looking at this from a security perspective, of concern to North Korea's neighbors, and certainly the United States, is the prospect of these satellite launches being used to allow North Korean scientists to hone their ballistic missile technology, particularly their intercontinental ballistic missile technology. Now, with each test of these UNHA series of satellite launch vehicles, North Korea learns a little bit more about what it takes to get an accurate, survivable, and reliable intercontinental ballistic missile that could potentially strike the U.S., at least the west coast of the United States, if we go by current range estimates. Now, my view, based on what I've read, from other experts who know far more about this stuff, is that North Korea is making progress. Particularly, it's shown that it can create a rocket that can carry an 800 kilogram payload at least, but it hasn't really solved some important problems that it would need to have a fully serviceable nuclear ballistic missile, particularly miniaturizing the nuclear warhead. And intelligence estimates vary on that, depending on who you ask. I think the South Koreans are less convinced. The Americans, I think, had acknowledged late last year that that was probably in North Korea's ability now, but we don't know for sure, as is the case with a lot of this. But also what we haven't seen North Korea really do is create a survivable re-entry vehicle, since an intercontinental ballistic missile has to re-enter Earth's atmosphere at several thousand kilometers an hour. And creating something that can carry a nuclear warhead and not simply disintegrate during that re-entry process is a non-trivial challenge, and North Korea hasn't really shown that it can do that. So anyways, that's kind of, my in-the-weeds assessment of the technology behind all this, but, we are the Diplomat, so I think there's a lot of interest in, obviously, the diplomatic ramifications of this. And, for context, this launch did take place a month after North Korea claimed to have tested a hydrogen bomb. It came, a month and a half after it tested its last submarine-launched ballistic missile. So really, we're seeing a pattern of provocation here to kick off the new year. So, Shannon, as our correspondent covering, all of China, Japan, South Korea, do you want to tell us a bit about, some of the diplomatic ramifications and how countries have reacted to this?
Sure. So I'm going to start by taking us back a little bit to right after North Korea's nuclear test in early January, where John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, very famously and very publicly said that he had told the Chinese that your approach is demonstrably not working, and so we cannot continue business as usual. And that has kind of become a refrain. I think it's been used a bit less provocatively since then, but both U.S. officials and South Korean officials, without necessarily directly targeting China, have said, we can't have business as usual anymore, meaning we can't have this pattern of North Korea tests a nuclear device or launches a rocket and everyone freaks out about it, comes up with some sanctions, and then outrage dies down. People forget about it. The sanctions don't really get enforced, and they weren't all that strict to begin with. So North Korea just starts preparing for its next test. Obviously, the key to breaking this cycle from the U.S. and South Korean point of view is to get China to cooperate, whether that means getting China to sign off on tougher sanctions, which is certainly something that the people in Washington have been trying to do for decades now, or whether that means just getting China to commit to more stringently enforcing the sanctions that are already in place. You know, North Korea is very economically dependent on China. So the thinking is that if you're going to have sanctions that actually severely penalize the North Korean regime and cut into its ability to fund these programs, China needs to be the major player. China, meanwhile, has shown pretty much no indication that it's changed its basic calculus on North Korea, which is that, yes, we don't want a nuclear North Korea, but what's worse from the Chinese perspective is having a collapsed North Korea, a North Korean state where the economy goes so far south that there's mass chaos, refugees pouring into northeastern China. Perhaps regime change, you know, chaos, civil war even. China doesn't want any of that. Their major talking point is stability. We want stability on the Korean Peninsula. And they've kind of implied all along that they would prefer a stable but nuclearized Korean Peninsula to an unstable but denuclearized one. So the question is how do you get China to change that calculus? And I think particularly South Korea, which spent a lot of time and a lot of energy making a warm relationship with China ever since Park Geun-hye came into office, they're really trying to send signals to China that you need to do something more. And one way they're doing that is by themselves taking an unprecedented step. They shut down the Kaesong Industrial Complex, which is something that previously had not happened during these provocations. North Korea had shut it down, but South Korea had said, we're going to keep this complex above these political provocations as kind of a symbol of Korean unity, a way of helping the North Korean people. But the government statement on the closure of Kaesong really emphasized how useful it was as a means of hard currency pouring into North Korea, and thus at least indirectly funding these missile programs and nuclear technology. And my reading of this is that they're doing this in part as a signal to China, because China has always said, okay, well, South Korea, you're telling us we need to stop our economic trading with North Korea, but you have the Kaesong Industrial Complex. It's still open. You're still doing business with the North Koreans. Why shouldn't we? So South Korea is preempting that line of logic. They're saying, we shut down our business with North Korea. Now it's your turn. And the other thing they're doing is more of a provocative move in Beijing's standpoint, which is obviously pursuing the THAAD missile defense system with the United States, which is something that China believes is a security threat to itself. And we can talk a little bit more about the logic for that. I know we're going to spend more time talking about the US approach to this as well, but that's kind of the stick approach to Beijing, right? Which is, okay, well, if you're not going to step in, if you're not going to pressure North Korea to get rid of its missiles, then we as South Koreans have to do something to take our security into our own hands. And that might include a missile defense system that you think is threatening to Chinese interests. And another kind of X factor to consider is trilateral cooperation between South Korea, Japan, and the US. The timing is really interesting because South Korea and Japan had just really gotten rid of a major obstacle to their cooperation with the Comfort Women deal right at the end of 2015. And obviously, there's still domestic criticisms on both sides and there's still questions about implementation. But they had this breakthrough diplomatic announcement right before a situation where it's absolutely critical for bilateral and trilateral cooperation involving both sides. What's interesting, though, is that in this instance, Japan might actually be more constrained than South Korea in terms of taking strong action because the issue of abducted Japanese citizens in North Korea and the need to get North Korean cooperation to find out their fate is such a politically sensitive topic in Japan that there's a lot of pressure on Abe not to take steps that could jeopardize that. And we've already seen that in the wake of Japan passing its own unilateral sanctions, North Korea has officially scrapped an investigation committee that they had set up promising to look into this issue. Now, obviously, they never made any progress. They never found any abductees that they could tell Japan, oh, here's what happened. There was no satisfaction coming from that, but it's still a strong political symbol that could be used against Abe by critics of his decision.
Awesome, Shannon. Thanks for that really, really thorough rundown of the diplomatic considerations here. And Prashant gets the fun question, which is, How does the United States react to this? I mean, how does John Kerry go from saying that we can't have business as usual to actually putting it into effect? Prashant, what's your sense of kind of the trade-offs involved here and the direction that the U.S. can take?
Yeah, so I think both of you sort of hit at the different pieces of the perennial question for U.S. policy on North Korea, which is the tension between the cyclical dimension, which is, every time, as Chen put it, North Korea carries out a provocation, there's talk of more sanctions, and then a debate between whether we should be pursuing more carrots, more sticks, what is the balance of where the sanctions should be placed, what should they involve, and then the question about what can China do, or how much more can China do? And this is sort of a cyclical question. But there's also the linear element, which is what you talked about, which is the technological capabilities of North Korea and the extent of the North Korean threat. So in the decades that we've been talking about the North Korean question, North Korea has been consistently developing its capability. So really the question is, and the broad question for U.S. policy is, how sustainable is the current approach on North Korea? And some people already argue that it's not very sustainable. So we should not dismiss these small-scale North Korean provocations as something that, they're relatively undesirable, but we can sort of live with it for now, because the North Korean threat is getting more serious. So business as usual is not really an option. So that's one component, I think, of the U.S. response more generally. I think in terms of the specifics, you've already seen some of the measures that have been undertaken. Shannon got into some of this. The acceleration of the passing of sanctions domestically. So the House passed sanctions today and sent it to Obama's desk. And it's expected to be approved. There'll be international sanctions are going to be pursued in the UN Security Council, as they have been before. The US South Korea alliance, Shannon mentioned the THAAD question. South Korea, I think for the first time, announced formally that they'll be entering talks into where and when the system will be deployed, which I think is the first time they've publicly announced an exact date for when the system will be deployed. So that's pretty significant. The US and Japan and South Korea had a trilateral meeting this week as well. They concluded that they would, increase intelligence sharing. So that's sort of the alliance piece of the equation, showing that the United States is working with its allies hand in glove on the North Korea situation. I think the final component that's interesting to consider, because it's the Obama administration's last year in office, is sort of its performance on the North Korea question on two counts. So the first is that the Obama administration came into office with, sort of signaling that with regimes like Myanmar, Iran, Cuba, North Korea, there would be this initial engagement opportunity with some of these countries. And you've seen limited successes in all three cases, with Myanmar, with Iran, and Cuba. Obviously, these cases, it remains to be seen how effective they'll eventually be. But in North Korea is kind of the, I would say, the odd one out in terms of how far the Obama administration has gone with the engagement. And it's not for the want of trying. I think the administration in early years tried definitely to get that engagement, but it's proven, a tough nut to crack, to say the least. I think the second part of this is what Shannon got to, which is Kerry's statement on, how much more can the United States get from China. So the Obama administration's China policy, if you want to put it very simply, is sort of, we will sort of cooperate with China when we can and try to extract additional cooperation from China on issues like climate change, and on issues where possible with North Korea, and in exchange, we will call China out on when it comes to South China Sea questions, when it comes to cyberspace. But really, in contrast to the Bush administration, the administration has taken a much softer line on China on some of these issues. So the issue is, how much of the additional movement has it gotten from China? And as Shannon pointed out, China has said that it's going to support, and it again said this week that it will support sanctions on North Korea. But aside from that, China, for its own interests, is not going to move significantly forward on the North Korean question, because it doesn't only have to do with North Korea for China. It has to do with the inflow of refugees, potentially, if there is a crisis. It also has to do with the U.S.-South Korea alliance and the U.S.-China relationship more generally. So the fact that South Korea is just close to China and it has, tens of thousands of U.S. troops is doesn't really make China feel very comfortable about giving in on the North Korean question. So that's an additional element to watch, I think.
Right, I have a lot. Yeah, I have a lot of reactions to that actually, Prashant. I mean, I thought it was very interesting that you pointed out that North Korea is kind of the case of engagement with a rogue state that didn't really work out for the Obama administration. I wonder, that's because if that's due to the strategic end state that the Obama administration has been seeking, which is denuclearization. And I think North Korea has made it abundantly clear, just through its testing, through its technological progress, that perhaps the window for denuclearization has passed. That North Korea has a substantial reserve of plutonium. It's currently working towards enriching uranium. It has, it's looking into hydrogen bomb technology, fission fuel. It's already pretty much carried out a boosted fission device test. This, it's kind of, I, you know, many people are saying, I mean, particularly you look like William Perry, the former U.S. Secretary of Defense, who's famously said that the United States must deal with North Korea as it is and not as the United States would like it to be. You look at what these people are saying, essentially, the conversation might have to shift to containment. And this is actually something Shannon and I recently discussed with Joel Witt, who was on the podcast with us. And Joel has, over 20 years of experience on this, and he was essentially, he pointed out that that's a political non-starter, simply because, it would be acknowledging a catastrophic failure in U.S. non-proliferation policy that North Korea had failed. And, there's also the fact that North Korea is outside of the rubric of the NPT, and you look at how the United States manages its relations with the other states that aren't signatories to the NPT but have nuclear weapons, including Israel, Pakistan, and India. And obviously, those are all three very different cases. Two of them are allies formally, and India is a partner state. North Korea is a hostile rogue state that, talks about wanting to destroy the United States and South Korea. So there's just politically, it's just very difficult to kind of change the conversation in the United States to go from denuclearization to containment. Shannon, I also wanted to get your sense of a possible trade-off with China or reordering diplomatic preferences with China. Right now, it seems like the Obama administration, at least, is more content to exchange whatever political capital it has with China on the issue of the South China Sea disputes, East China Sea disputes, perhaps even the cyber issue. What would happen if the United States said that North Korea should be at the top of its bilateral agenda with China, in your view? Is that something that could potentially, lead to some sort of grand bargain where China comes around if the United States says that it will simply back off the issue of, freedom of navigation in the South China Sea and says that this is our number one priority as a denuclearized Korean Peninsula and you need to work with us, and in exchange we can offer this? What do you think?
I think it depends a lot on what else the US is willing to bring to the table, right? Because right now we've seen, as you said, the South China Sea is towards the top of the US priority list. I'm not really seeing any signs of Chinese cooperation on that issue. I mean, you are seeing some basic kind of trust building, conflict avoidance measures, but in terms of getting China to actually do the things the US wants it to do, we're not seeing that. And that's just because China's strategic interests are almost diametrically opposed to the United States. China wants to defend its sovereign territory. The US wants it to uphold freedom of navigation, and the two sides don't quite agree on what that means. So that's the same problem that we would have with North Korea. If the US suddenly makes North Korea its top priority, but it is still asking China to do the same things in the same way, they're not going to make any progress because, as Prashant was saying, this is a fundamental security concern for China. From the Chinese point of view, what the US is basically asking China to do is sacrifice its national security, really for no reason. Because, as we've all mentioned, North Korea is already a nuclear state. And I think there is a sense in China that, okay, that ship has sailed. What's really the point of beating that dead horse further and insisting on denuclearization? And there's even a strain of thought in China that North Korea isn't actually all that dangerous. They're all bark and no bite. There was a recent essay by a professor at Zhejiang University that claimed South Korea doesn't have anything to fear from North Korea because North Korean media has said South Korea doesn't have anything to fear from North Korea. There's a fundamental disagreement on the nature of the threat and how to deal with the threat. And the US could definitely achieve more if it makes this a priority, but it also has to change kind of the parameters of the argument and what it's talking about. And I think that would take a lot more reassurance to China, that the US is ultimately willing to engage in dialogue with North Korea, that we're not just going to slap sanctions on them and then leave the regime to crumble into dust. Although I'm sure there are some people in the US who would like to see that. It's not really a very responsible strategy. I think China could also use some reassurance directly from South Korea and the US about, what the approach would be if the Kim regime did collapse. Would it mean US and South Korean allied forces storming up to the Chinese border? That's obviously something that's very concerning to China. Would China just be completely alone in dealing with this massive influx of refugees? Another thing that's very concerning to China. So if they can talk about these issues and really address China's core concerns, which are fundamentally the collapse of the North Korean regime and all of the attendant security issues that would cause for China, then you might be able to see some movement on the North Korea issue. But if you just make it a priority and you keep saying the same things that we've been saying, I don't see anything different happening from China's end.
Right. Prashant, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely agree with most of what Shannon said. I think the issue with North Korea and trying to get a change from China on U.S. policy is that people disagree both on the downsides and the upsides, right? So people, the issue about how bad could the situation get, people disagree there, and some people say, well, the North Koreans are going to engage in low-scale provocations, but we can pretty much contain the situation. So that militates against a change in policy, and then on the upside. Unlike some of the other cases that we talked about, including the ones you mentioned, so Iran, for example, when there was that nuclear deal that was done, the issue that was made was that there's this huge upside of this, U.S.-Iran relationship. Iran is going to become, one of the closest U.S. partners in the Middle East, in the next 30, 40 years. You don't see the same argument being made about U.S.-North Korea relations. I mean, North Korea, it's not quite geopolitically irrelevant, but relative to Iran and some of the other countries that we're talking about, the upside for the United States is not significant. In fact, if you look at the estimates for Korean unification, it's going to be a huge economic cost to get this done. So, because of disagreements both on the upside and the downside, and then you bring into the question what Shannon pointed out, which I think is a really important point. Where does North Korea fit in the hierarchy of priorities that the United States wants in its relationship with China? Relative to other questions like, the South China Sea, and some of these other questions, and there's a huge laundry list, so cybersecurity goes on and on. North Korea isn't really on the top of that list. So that's another question to consider.
Great. So I kind of want to, take the podcast towards the end, but I also want to do a little bit of, crystal ball gazing, as it were, as it always is when talking about what North Korea is about to do. But, I mean, I found myself asking why we've kind of seen this pattern of provocation from North Korea beginning, the new year. I mean, a satellite launch, nuclear test, showing off its submarine-launched missiles, particularly because at his New Year's address, Kim Jong-un emphasized economic development, and it was actually fairly, he didn't really focus on the country's nuclear weapons or talk too much about destroying the United States. It was more about economic development, and that made a lot of sense since, unlike his father, Kim's kind of strategic view of where North Korea is going is captured in the phrase, Byungjin, which is the idea that North Korea will simultaneously pursue its nuclear weapons deterrent and also pursue economic prosperity. Now, Kim Jong-il, by contrast, had pursued, the Sung-un policy of military first, which had cost the country dearly, famine in the 1990s and economic ruin, essentially. And, I wonder with this upcoming party congress that's happening in North Korea, which I think is happening for the first time in decades, in most communist states, a party congress is a fairly regular occurrence, but in North Korea, it just simply hasn't happened in this long time. And I wonder if, by kind of setting these provocations off, Kim is showing others inside the North Korean regime that the military side of things, the nuclear side of things, is doing well, then the time is coming now to focus on the economic prosperity half of the Pyongyang equation, which he hasn't really focused on. So I wonder, and this might be a little bit too optimistic, but I wonder if we'll see something major announced on the economic front at the Workers' Party Congress later this year. Now, if I had to ask, I guess, both of you to kind of end the podcast off on just kind of, a note of what to watch on the Korean Peninsula going into the rest of this year, either diplomatically or in terms of what the United States might do, what would you like to highlight? Shannon, do you want to start off?
Sure. I would say something to pay close attention to is how muscular South Korea wants to get in its own security response to the provocations we've seen so far this year and any hypothetical ones in the future. There's been talk of a fifth nuclear test at some point this year. So in addition to the deployment of THAAD, which is obviously a huge step for South Korea, as Prashanth noted, there's also been some rumblings amongst the scholarly community that South Korea should start pursuing its own nuclear weapons, which is pretty unlikely, I would say, but the fact that it's being openly discussed is a sign that South Korea is very concerned about this and might be heading in a very muscular security direction in the future due to this kind of existential threat from its northern neighbor. So that's something I would say to watch.
Great. And Prashant?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I mean, you both have pointed out, I think, the key things to watch. I think the Congress is important. The fifth test, which I think South Korean officials were pointing out as early as January, is something to watch. And I think also the THAAD question is extremely interesting because I think for the U.S. and South Korea, the perspective is that they're reacting to a North Korean threat that's getting more serious. But from China's perspective, the more that these initiatives are pursued, the more it becomes clear that China shouldn't really move very quickly and very decisively on the North Korean question as the United States and South Korea wants it to do, because it makes it even clearer that North Korea, it's not just a question about North Korea, it's a question of the U.S.-South Korea alliance very strongly being manifested on China's borders. And so that would actually lessen the incentive for China to react. And all this obviously is very interesting during a U.S. presidential election year, where I think you'll see a lot of rhetoric, and you're already seeing a lot of rhetoric, including from Donald Trump on North Korea.
Right. I think Trump said that he would ask the Chinese to assassinate Kim Jong-un.
Exactly.
And let's not get into the realism of that proposal.
That's a podcast for another day.
Yeah, exactly. We can go over hypothetical scenarios for how that would actually work out. I think the interview is actually about that, right? I still haven't seen that movie. I should probably do that. I would just add, one final thing. And this is kind of going back to the technical notes about this, satellite technology. Something that I'm personally looking forward to is, the eventual findings from the UN Security Council, which did a report after the 2012 launch, in which it kind of broke down the debris that was recovered from the satellite launch, and it kind of showed that, North Korea was getting a lot of its components from China, Russia, even the United States and the United Kingdom, and South Korea. So it'll be interesting to see, where if this test was evolutionary or revolutionary. Everything I've seen suggests to me that it was more evolutionary on the 2012 test, suggesting that North Korea is trying to get it right rather than, increase its range or increase the lethality of its weapon necessarily. So that'll again be something to look out for. Guys, thanks a lot for coming on today. This was a very interesting discussion, I thought.
Ready to do it.
Sure, yeah, always glad to join.
Great. And if you like listening to this podcast, please make sure to subscribe on iTunes and TuneIn, and do leave us a review with your feedback. Thanks for listening.